This is a People First Radio podcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Marnie Panas, a transgender woman from Edmonton, has discovered that by being authentic and true to herself, she has found the strength to move forward in life. Marnie Panas transitioned to a woman and legally adopted a female name in the spring of 2014. Since that time, she has become one of the foremost Canadian advocates for the rights of transgender people. One of Marnie's current roles is to act as an engagement and patient experience consultant for the Alberta Health Service.
Marnie Panas presented at a conference last week in Calgary, Alberta, that was focused on developing collaborative mental health care services and approaches. We share Marnie's complete presentation from that conference on today's People First Radio program.
The reason why I want to share my story with you is to consider your own personal values and your own personal life experiences and whatever it is that brings you to your practice as mental health practitioners. We want to increase the awareness of people who identify as transgender and the related health care and customer service issues with respect to that, to develop ways to deliver culturally safe customer service to our patients, our clients, and to build comfort to provide culturally comprehensive care to our patients. So that's kind of the focus of today. And I'm hoping that we'll accomplish that through hearing some of the bits and pieces of my journey. This is my quote that has got me through many, many challenges. To be yourself in a world that is constantly trying to make you something else is the greatest accomplishment. We all spend our lives trying to fit into what society expects of us as women, as men, as professionals, as sports players, as a Caucasian. All of those things are what society expects of us. But when you can finally be you and live your own truth, sometimes despite of, or maybe even because of, what society expects of you, that's a very freeing, liberating, healthy place to be. So why is it important to learn about sexual and gender diversity? Many people who identify as being sexually diverse and gender diverse have many unmet health care needs, or they identify that they're not receiving good care. Human rights legislation certainly mandates that we should expect the same level of care and service as anybody else in society. And there's an increasing awareness of sexual and gender diversity can increase the quality of care we provide to everyone. So this is not just about me, it's not just about being a transgender person, but if we can open our minds to be really inclusive and caring and compassionate to our clients, to our patients who happen to be transgender, or whatever it is that is different, that helps us in our care that we provide to everyone. It's also important to learn because it's a personal experience, it's my lived experience, the stigma I've received, the discrimination I've received coming along, all of those things make it difficult for me to access care. We're less likely to access care. It could be discrimination in a doctor's office. Maybe we're going to a psychologist and the psychologist says, I have no experience with transgender people, so I can't help you. Yet I'm going there to see this person about my bereavement, about losing my son. And so often we get those experiences, so then we're less likely to come back. And that leads to negative health outcomes, physically and mentally. So it's a lived experience that is the barrier to healthcare, not the fact that I'm transgender. The outcomes for transgender people or LGBTQ people, because of that discrimination, because of that stigma, because of that perception in society that we're less likely or more likely to have heart disease, obesity, mental health concerns, substance abuse, interpersonal violence. One in every two transgender people will have experienced abuse, physical or sexual abuse, at the hands of their intimate partner. One in every two. And of course, certain cancers. We're less likely to participate in health promotion activities, such as screening for cervical cancer, for all kinds of things, we're less likely to participate. So it becomes a public health issue as well. Let's talk a little bit about gender. We have to throw out the notion of the stick figure and the triangle girl that you see on bathroom walls. We have to get rid of that, and we are getting rid of that, because gender is a spectrum. People will identify with one or the other or somewhere in between or neither at all or none at all. And that's important that we have to open our mind to that. Sex is a legal determination made at birth based on whether a child has a penis or a vagina. Simple as that. It's a legal determination. Once they see your penis, they'll put male on your birth certificate. Where gender is a social construct of society, how we dress, how we do our hair, how we speak, how we act, how we interact with each other, it has little to do with whether I have a penis or vagina, my gender, but it's in my heart, my soul, my mind, my body, and the way that I live, the way that I talk, the way that I feel. Everything about me says I'm a female. Whether I have a penis or vagina is frankly nobody's business. That's, for most people, sex and gender align. But for 1% of the population, that doesn't align, where the gender and sex do not align, and that's where you end up feeling transgender, where you have the gender identity dysphoria.
You're listening to People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM Community Radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. Marnie Panis is a transgender woman living in Edmonton, Alberta. She was in Calgary last week speaking to a group of mental health care practitioners and interested family members at a conference focused on collaborative mental health care.
Marnie's presentation was designed to encourage delegates to consider personal and professional values related to sexual and gender diversity, to increase awareness of people who identify as transgender and related healthcare and customer service issues, to develop knowledge of ways to deliver culturally safe customer service to all patients, and to build comfort to provide culturally competent care to all patients. Marnie Panis's personal story was a key component of her appearance at the conference. Here's that inspiring story.
So we'll start a little bit about my story. I was born and designated male sex at birth because I was born with a penis. It's just as simple as that, really. It gets more complex when you have ambiguous genitalia, but that's out of the scope of my conversation today, but something we have to be aware of. I was born into a Catholic family, very Catholic. It was a small town in central East Alberta. I didn't meet anybody who wasn't Caucasian Christian until I was probably 13 years old. And I remember that specifically because our priest came from the Ivory Coast. And that's the first time I actually shook hands, touched, saw somebody that close to me that wasn't Caucasian. And so that kind of gives you some perspective of the life or the sheltered existence that I was raised in that, which is very common for everybody and a lot of people in that generation. But I started dressing whenever I could. In my mom's clothes, my sister's clothes, never making a connection to gender. I'm 43 years old, so if you can think back 35 years ago, I didn't have internet. I was lucky if we got that third channel, if the wind was blowing right. So I didn't have that context. I didn't hear the word transgender probably until my 30s. I didn't hear the word homosexual probably until my 20s. So I never heard those words, so I didn't have a language to talk about how I felt. I just knew I didn't feel that I could provide what was expected of me as a young boy, that I just didn't fit in. I just didn't know why. I didn't have that language. And that's why you probably see a lot more younger people expressing their gender identity now, because that language is there, the awareness is there, and language is power. When you can really articulate how you feel and who you are, that becomes power to you. But that took a long time for me to find that. I just knew I didn't fit in. I would dress up and all that. And some people ask, how could you at 7 years old know that you're transgender? Well, I didn't know I was transgender then. But, you know, if I ask anybody in this room who identifies as a cisgender female, how long have you known? And the answer I always get is, well, I've always known. Well, how do you know? Well, it's just who I am. Why is that different for a transgender person? Why do we have to explore that further? Well, of course, you couldn't possibly have known. Well, you knew. How come I can't know that? Right? So we still have to think internally about how we knew about our gender. Why is that different for a transgender person? I continue on going to this school in this small town. Again, I didn't belong to my family. I didn't belong to my school. I didn't belong with friends. I didn't know why. You know, my family were also very sheltered in their upbringing as well. Limited education we had. And there's some generally racist comments that were often made around our dinner table and things that it was just part of how things were done then. And even then, I didn't feel right. Even had no other context, I didn't feel that I fit into that expectation either. I wanted to play with the girls didn't want to play with me, I didn't belong with the boys. And again, still then, still dressing all this time, never making a connection to gender. I guess the best thing I could say at that time was that I didn't know who I was, I just knew who I wasn't. But I could never figure out who I was, and it took me another 30 some odd years before I figured that out. Growing up, things didn't improve very much. This was taken on Halloween, it was in grade 3, and I remember this is the first time I ever went outside. My mom dressed me up as a bride, it was the best Halloween ever. Best. Oh, it was so much fun. I was like, on fire. It was great. I still never made a connection to the fact that I was out as a girl. But, oh, wow, was that great. I'm sure my mom would probably wish that that never happened, but that was my first time out. In high school, I became very lonely and depressed. You get comfortable in being lonely. You get comfortable in your secret. You get really, really, really good at keeping secrets. And hiding those clothes that you've been trying on, and hiding, you know, because you know, even though it was never specifically said to me, you know that if you ever said anything about how you were feeling, or that you liked wearing girls' clothes, I couldn't even imagine the response I would have got from my family, my friends, how horrible that would have been. So you just know that, you just feel it, so you don't say it, and you get really good at being by yourself. I met Lorena in 1996. Something extra special about her. I'd had many other relationships that ended about the time they found out that I had another side to me. But Lorena, I knew there was something really special. And how did I know that? Because it took us 7 days before I got the courage to actually give her a kiss on the cheek. And so I just knew there was something different. So I knew I also had to tell her quite early on. And it was a month into our relationship where I told her about my cross-dressing and that other part. And even though we come from the same culture, same age, same demographics, all the things were the same, she was raised in quite a different environment where everything was, she was raised with a much more open mind, a much more compassionate feeling about her, that she just saw me and she loved me and said, "That's okay. I love you." And this July 18th, we'll have been married 17 years. We got married in 1998. I must admit, I kind of wanted to wear the dress. Kind of a tough day for me, but happy that I had an amazing wife, an amazing bride, but boy, she sure looked in that dress. Lorena would later show me the world, both globally, physically, and literally and figuratively within myself. Travel opened my eyes from that person that never met somebody who wasn't white for the first 13 years of their life to someone that experienced diversity in this world. The different cultures, different races, different people, this thing started to make sense to me of the world. In 2006, we had boys that were born at, twin boys, Alex and Andrew, that were born at 24 weeks gestation. That's 3.5 months early. Very, very, very sick. And this part is, this story is relevant because it took us 7 years to try and have children. We spent many, many, many times in doctor's offices and clinics. And I remember specifically one time having to do a sperm analysis and getting the results back. And they, I remember it said, "Poor quality sperm. Don't you love healthcare?" As if I need more judgment, then now you have poor quality sperm. And I remember sitting outside my wife's office, sobbing, thinking to myself, "I'm not even man enough to be a father." And that was so profound that I struggled with that for years. Finally, thank goodness to Foothills Clinic down the road there, that we were blessed with twin boys through the help of in vitro fertilization. But because of a whole bunch of other issues, the boys had to be delivered very, very early, and again, very sick. And I remember that very difficult time. We spent 5 months in the hospital, in the NICU. Alex, he was in palliative care after the first week because his lungs were so sick that it was time that he was going to die. So it was time we had to talk about withdrawing care. And we took him out of the isolette. And he's our 8-year-old, and he's happy and healthy, doing great today. And Andrew passed away 4 months later. He never did get to come home. And throughout all of that time, as a parent, as a father in the NICU, you're expected, or at least I felt society expects me to keep my stuff together, to try and save my family, to try and protect my family, to send out word, to make the decision. Somehow I had to pay the bills. Somehow I had to figure out how I'm going to go to work and pay the mortgage and communicate with everybody. And I just want to protect my family. And my wife almost died the night that the boys were born. And so I'm in the basement of the hospital, crying where nobody can see me because boys don't show emotion. And I'll never forget that. I just didn't know where I fit even in that environment. It was a very difficult time. But that also, time also changes you in many ways, the way that you see the world. And for me, it taught me about living life without regret. That picture on the bottom there was the first time I ever got to hold my boys together at the same time. My favorite moment ever. Not knowing then that would be the only time I would ever hold them together. And so that moment taught me again about living life without regret, to appreciate each special moment and to treasure the moments of your life. Now, that led into a whole bunch of other issues for myself, which included having to deal with bereavement, and I had a lot of mental health support to go through that part of my journey, trying to figure out my own gender, trying to figure out all those things, and it was very, very difficult.
You're listening to People First Radio, across the islands on CHLY 101.7 FM and streaming online at chly.ca. Marnie Panis is a transgender woman living in Edmonton, Alberta. She was in Calgary last week speaking to a group of mental health care practitioners and interested family members at a conference focused on collaborative mental health care.
Marnie used her personal story as a way to illustrate important elements in the provision of health care to people who identify as being sexually diverse. Marnie said that folks who identify as sexually diverse often have important unmet health care needs or can report that they are not receiving good customer care. But human rights legislation mandates that people be provided with equal access to public services regardless of their sexuality. Here's more of Marnie Panis' story.
It was about 3 years ago this November. We were on a holiday together, and it was soon after that that I finally realized what was going on. This was our family picture, and I remember I was on a beach in North Carolina with a friend, and I was uploading a picture of myself on the beach. And I was looking at Facebook, put on Facebook, and then I just started to cry and cry and cry, because for the first time in my life, I was 40 years old. The first time in my life, I saw me looking back at me. I was a girl on a beach. And then it all clued in. My feelings in the NICU, my fear and dressing up as a child, not fitting in, all those things all came to me and said, this is who you are. Even though I always sort of knew, that was the defining moment. And I came back to Lorena soon after. And I told her that for the first time, I am transgender. And that started a whole other part of the story. On January 23rd of last year, I was still working at the Stollery Children's Hospital at the time, very afraid of what was about to happen. But I posted this. I read this letter to all of the Stollery managers that was part of my peer team. And then I posted this letter to my friends on Facebook, on our blog, everywhere. And now my secret was gone. And, you know, there's something interesting when you think about mental health. Even in that secret, I had to grieve the loss of my secret. Because that secret was safe to me. It was a place I could hide in. It was a place I could go to. And now the whole world is going to know. And so I actually had to grieve the loss of something that was so me that nobody else knew. So I had to figure that out. It's just something to think about. When you come out as being transgender, everything changes. You know, somebody can come out as gay or lesbian, and certainly in their life a lot can change. And I'm not going to try even come close to comparing hard of one to the other story. But you know, there could be many in this room that have come out as transgender, but nobody would notice unless they told them who they're sleeping with, quite frankly. For me, people like me, when I come out as transgender, everything changes. How people relate to me, the words to describe me, the interactions that we have, the name changes, my look changes, the pronouns that I want people to use, everything changes. So it requires one to renegotiate every relationship. The most important part of the relationship was one that I had to renegotiate with myself. Coming out isn't a matter of what I want. It's not a matter of what's best for me and the time that was perfect for me. One comes out when they finally get past the fear of what society will do to you when they find out. that's when one decides to come out, when they finally can get past that fear. And that fear is very, very real. But it's in that moment, the hardest part of my journey was loving myself, finding that self-love, then finding self-respect, and then finally self-determination. But none of that was possible until I could get validated within myself. And I remember that when I was, for the last 10 years prior to my transition, I was actually in the drag queen world, and I could be this whole other persona, and I was bigger than life. I could travel all over North America and be on stage, and people tell you that you're beautiful and you're pretty and you're the most popular person in the room, things I never heard of growing up. I was quite invisible growing up, and that's beautiful. I can go and walk a red carpet with Sharon Stone, and I was in the Glee movie and all those kinds of things. Wow, that's really great stuff. And that validation that I was getting, something I didn't get in 30 years. And then I would come home, and I'd be an angry ass of a man at home who would yell at Alex, who would have road rage, who would be angry when I'd lose my keys, all those kinds of things, because this pendulum would swing to that other side, and I'd be a real jerk at home. And so once I found myself, once I found who I truly was, that pendulum stopped swinging, because I knew that that validation that I was getting way up here, it's superficial, it's not real, and it's not sustainable, and it's not what drives me. And now when I have found myself, I'm not even angry on the other side. Not too long ago, I was looking for my keys, because I seem to lose my keys a lot. I don't know what's going on. And I'm just looking around, and I'm like methodically going through my stuff quietly, and my wife is standing there just watching me go back and forth. I'm like, here they are, and then we went out the door. And she's like, what just happened? I'm like, what are you talking about? Because the old me would have lost it. And I would have torn the house apart. I would have been swearing at some point. And nope, I just found my keys, and away we went. And it was so profound, that change in that mental health part of it, that I was able to find that balance. My therapist laughs because before, I'm a runner as well, and I run marathons, or I try to, and before I used to know every tenth of a kilometer I've ever run before, and now I don't run, or I run and it'll be 2 weeks before I even log it in my little spreadsheet. And again, because I was very compulsive and I needed to have those things, once I found my balance, I didn't have to work so hard at that other stuff. And so when you're unbalanced, when you're not happy and healthy within yourself, then it manifests itself in many different ways. And I can't even remember the last time I had road rage. That's the part that was the biggest part for me. And it's in that moment that you can love yourself, that you can love others the way that they deserve. Like my son, I was physically pushing him away from me, knowing that we lost a child. We tried so hard to save him, and here I was pushing him away. And now we are closer than ever. So it clearly has to renegotiate our relationship as spouses. We don't consider ourselves homosexual or lesbian or anything. We're the same people to each other. But clearly, that changes. Our intimacy changes. All of that changes. You know, there wasn't too long ago where we were at it was about a year ago, just after transition, we were at a restaurant. And we went on one of our rare date nights together without Alex. And the server asked us if we wanted separate checks. And in 17 years, we'd never been asked that question. And of course, so it occurs to us that we now look different to the rest of the world, even though we look the same to each other. And that's also something to think about, that we're also much more aware of where we show emotion in public. Because there are certain places still in this world, even in our city, in our province, where we have to be thoughtful of that and mindful of that. And that's taking some getting used to. The part of that relationship, though, when I came home from that trip in North Carolina, my wife said to me, "This is something you have to do. I just don't know if I can be there on the other side." And that's a fair statement. And as I mentioned, she is on the other side, but she got one of the best pieces of advice from her therapist. We went together, and she also had one on her own, who said, "When in doubt, do nothing. When in doubt, do nothing." She could have left. She could have taken Alex and leave. It would have been the easiest thing for her. People wouldn't have judged her for that. In fact, more people have judged her for staying with someone like me. But her therapist said, "Don't do anything. If you don't know what's going on, just don't do anything." So we went through our therapy, our conversations got deeper. When you kind of come up with this kind of stuff, the other stuff doesn't matter anymore, right? There are no more secrets. And in there, we found a level of intimacy that I actually never even realized existed, that you can't even describe in a relationship. Because when you get rid of your masks, and you are real with each other, you just get to that deeper place. and it's pretty amazing, really. And so she is amazing. Had to renegotiate the relationship with my son. He still calls me daddy. He's 8 years old. And that throws off some people at Costco or wherever we are. But I'm like, that's right, I'm his daddy. And of course, people don't want to believe that tomorrow is Father's Day. And I know the school, his school is amazing. It's a Catholic school. And the all the dads get a present from their kids that made, but mine's a little bit different. And that's what I hear. I can't wait to see it tomorrow. And so, but he still calls me daddy. He'll figure that out as he gets older. If he wants to change that, that'll be up to him. I've never forced him into anything. We try and remind him that I'm a she. And he's asked those questions. Again, he did ask, you know, daddy, am I like you? Was something that he asked quite early on. And so we kind of explored that. He asks why, and I'll, you know, we try and reach children where they're at, right? If he's asking about his brother who passed away, I'll ask him, so what do you think happened with your brother? Just to see where he's at. And then we'll take it from there. But at the end of the day, Alex and children that age, they want to feel loved. They want to feel safe. They want to feel secure in their family and in their home. And he feels all of those things and more. And we are the best of friends, which says a lot considering that I really would have lost him had I not finally faced that. We are thriving. Children see things as black and white. And his buddies come around, and I'll never forget that. And this is why he has this sign. It was, again, a month or two after, no, it was just about before my transition. My neighbors were starting to know, but not really. I used to go in my garage, get my car, and then back out when nobody could see me and scoot off, because I didn't want people to see me. And one particular day I was coming home in my summer dress, and my son was playing basketball on the driveway. I'm like, uh-oh, I'm like, what do I do? And so I get up there and he throws me the basketball. I'm in my dress, see, and we're in public and our neighbors, and he just throws me the basketball. So we're playing basketball. I didn't want to show that I was embarrassed or scared. And then his two little buddies drive by on their bikes. Again, he's 6 years old. And he sees his buddy stopping to watch us, like, who's this person? And he picks up his ball, walks on over and said, she's my daddy, with all the conviction in the world. And I knew in that moment that he was probably going to be a lot healthier about it than I was going to be. And he has taught me so much about unconditional love that I only wish I could give him a fraction of what he's shown me. He's great. So that's our family, our new family, our new normal. And I'm thinking we're a pretty happy, good-looking family.
You're listening to People First Radio, coming to you on CHLY 101.7 FM, streaming online at chly.ca. We've been sharing audio from a presentation by Marnie Panis at the 2015 Canadian Collaborative Mental Health Care Conference in Calgary, Alberta.
Marnie's presentation was titled, I'm Not Sick, I'm Transgender, and it was designed to help mental health practitioners work more appropriately and effectively with and support and advocate for sexual and gender minority patients and clients. Here's more from Marnie Panis.
I had to renegotiate the relationship with my parents. This message is a reminder of the last time I tried to communicate with my parents. I told them in October of 2013, I guess, not even 2 years. And it was at Thanksgiving, and we'd been very close as a family. I have another sibling, an older sister. We've been very close, but on that day, we were asked to leave the house. A couple days later, I was phoned by my mom, who told me I was a disgrace to women. I was a disgrace to the family. I was a disgrace to them, that I had been brainwashed by those people being the gay, lesbian friends that I had. 2 days later, I got a registered letter in the mail to remind me of all those things, because as if the phone call wasn't enough, let's make sure that you know. And then 2 days after that, I got a phone call from my dad who simply said, you no longer have parents and we don't want to see you again. And I haven't heard from him since. Now we've tried to reach out. I've seen mom a couple times. There's a lot of stuff going on there. But a few weeks ago, last ditch effort to send a letter and to try and keep that communication open somehow, some way. And that's what I got. And as difficult as that is, the hurt still hurts. I know I'm in a healthier place. It's really difficult. And I think when I think back of growing up, when I was being told that you're always the problem, that, you know, we would be sitting at a kitchen table, my sister would pick on me and I would cry or I'd fight back, I'd get in trouble for it. And any of that, it'd always be me and you're, you know, too educated, you're too this, you're too this, you're too this, you're too emotional. And if a racist comment was made and I would challenge that, I was the problem. And again, it was my therapist this time who had by far the most amazing words of wisdom for me. He said, all of your life you have been led to believe that you are a black sheep in a white sheep family. You ever think that maybe, just maybe, you might be the white sheep in a black sheep family? Wow. That just blew my mind. Because all of that time I thought I was the problem in our family, that I was making the problem, that it was my fault that they can't go for coffee in their small town anymore. And I can now say that I am a good person. I am a kind person. I love my community. I love my family. I'm a great parent. I'm good with that. The fact that you can't go for coffee in your community, that's your problem. You got to figure that out, not mine. That completely reframed everything in my life and how I looked at myself, let alone my family, the world around me. That now, and for the first time, I could say, I don't give you permission to hurt me anymore. That whatever I get is from within me. And that is incredibly freeing and liberating as a person. Renegotiation with friends. Two lifelong friends had told me, lifelong, like knew me from birth, said they were not comfortable being seen with me anymore. They would refuse to use the correct pronouns. I don't ever respect you anymore, were the words that they used. And those friendships ended. Because in that moment I said, well, if you can't respect me, then clearly we're not friends. So this is the end of this friendship. And I got really good at saying that. Because if there are certain boundaries that I have and certain expectations of a friendship, and if you can't meet that, I'm good to say goodbye. That's two people. But I also have a whole pile of other friends and a whole many more new friends. Another group of friends that I had, we would always go out for movie together. It'd be five guys, six guys. We called it guys movie night. And we'd go and eat a good dinner and talk about stuff, you know, all the things in our lives going on. Then we'd go see a really bad movie that our wives would never want to go to. And then I transitioned. And there was this little talk about, well, what's going to happen now? This is this guy's club. Marnie just really screwed this up. So the very next invite is called guys plus one movie night. It really was as simple as that for them. And we still talk about the same things. We're still great friends. We still seem to see crappy movies. And nothing really has changed. Except I'm a lot happier when I'm with them. I had to renegotiate with my faith. I told you I'm a Catholic woman. For a few years prior to my transition, I started to pull away from my faith. For quite obvious reasons. I don't think I have to go into the detail of doctrine and all that kind of stuff to figure out that I was probably not going to be welcome there. And so I started to pull back. And then I thought, you know, in every part of my life, whether it was the physicians I was working with, the families I was working with, my own family, everybody, I always had this notion that if you give an opportunity for people to be kind, they almost usually are. So I'm not going to make any assumptions. I'm not going to make any judgments. I'm simply going to ask the question. So we had a meeting with our priest, my son was there, and I said, this is what's going on in my life. Will we be able to continue to practice our faith the way that we always have? And he said, I have no idea. He said, but do you mind if I take a couple days to think about it? I'm like, wow, okay, I can live with that. I wish everybody responded that way, actually. If you don't know, then don't say anything, right? A couple days later, he didn't phone, but the bishop phoned. And this is Ukrainian Catholic, by the way. And so he phones and said, yeah, can you come in for tea? Okay. So my wife and I get summoned to the big house. And I asked him the same question. And he says, an overwhelming yes. I'm like, whoa. So I didn't expect it. And he said, the church, you have to remember, is a who, not a what. It's made up of people. And we try and be kind and open and compassionate. But because we're a people, we're fallible, and we don't always get it right. You may not always experience kindness, but I will always be kind and welcoming to you. Like, wow, still gets me. And then we talked about communion, and he said, you know, the Holy Eucharist is a prize, is not a prize for the rich and the perfect, but a medicine for the poor and the weak. Who among us are perfect? He says, I will give you communion. And then we talked about a few other things. We spent an hour together, and at the very end, he asks, how can we, as a church, support you and your family? And wow, you know, still feels it because my faith grew more in that 1 hour than in all of my life. And so we've gone back every Sunday, and we're very much part of the community, the church, the congregation in our church are just loving and welcoming, and especially the older people, the ladies asked me to be a leader in the Sunday school, and my son just celebrated his first Holy Communion, and the lady that was teaching him said, okay, boys and girls, bring your mums and dads or your mums up to pray. And in just those simple words, models kindness and compassion and welcoming, that you don't have to change doctrine of a church to be open and kind to your neighbor. And that's what I've learned. I had to change a lot of relationships with government and for business. This was a big deal, the day that I changed my birth certificate, because up until recently, you had to prove whether you had a penis or vagina before you could change your gender marker on your birth certificate. You actually had to prove whether you had a penis or vagina for a lot of services. Could you imagine? Most people in this room probably have never been asked that question at a border crossing, applying for life insurance or car insurance, a driver's license, that you actually had to discuss your genitals. You'd be surprised how many times I've had to been asked that question. Where in human rights is that okay, that I'm separated from everybody else because they're asking me about my genitals? So the day that I got my birth, or that I was about to apply for my birth certificate, I've changed my name, a new court decision came through, a human rights decision came through, that said that they don't have to ask that question anymore. So I phoned up Vital Statistics and I said, I'm applying for my birth certificate, do I need to prove anything, will you honor that court decision? And of course they didn't know, but an hour later the director phoned me back and said, yep, we'll do that. And next day I had a birth certificate with my name, with my correct gender, without ever having to discuss what body parts I have, and I became the first one in Alberta to do that. And that was pretty profound because that changes everything. Everything goes back to that birth certificate. My passport, not too many people are just going to stand out in front of Canada Place and take a picture with their new passport, but I did because I was really excited as a transgender person traveling around the world. I love to travel. We like to take our son traveling. Looking like me with a male passport is a problem, a real serious problem. In 70 countries in the world, it's illegal to be homosexual. They don't make the distinction between homosexuality and being transgender. So I face not being allowed into countries, to be arrested if I try, or beat up or killed in those countries. The moment I got my passport with my correct gender marker on it, I got my options back again. So now we can do that travel. A little side note, my car insurance went down. On the day that I phoned my insurance company, they said, well, statistically speaking, you are now a better driver. All kinds of unfair there going on. But I didn't exactly turn my $100 a year back. That was a really great moment. It changed my relationship at work. This had never happened at the Stollery before, at Alberta Health Services. Somebody at my level in the management field that was going to transition. It's kind of a big deal. So they had to do it right, and I felt that they had to do it right. And they really did. They really guided me. My senior leaders, HR, even communications, all got involved and really supported me. And they just said, we'll follow you as you go. We're not going to push you. We're not going to hold you back. But we will walk this with you until we'll get this right. And they really, really did. And I was really scared. I loved my work because it was my boy's experience in NICU that brought me to healthcare. I was in software before. After a health issue in the NICU, I went back to school, got my degree. I worked in the NICU helping other families in their journeys. I loved it so much, and I was so scared of losing it because for transgender people, discrimination in the workplace is very real. In Ontario, I want to say that the average income for transgender women is less than $18,000 a year. And in that cohort, we're including people with masters and PhDs. And so it's a real, real problem. And so that's scary. I love my work so much. But because it was in that environment that, you know, people are in the business to care in that environment, and they really cared about me. And so what I've learned in that is that, you know, since then, I've since gotten a promotion. I've gone into so many amazing things in this last year that never would have thought was possible before because I was just trying so hard to hide who I was. I'm more productive. My team around me is more productive. And the way I see it is that when you can create a climate where you can bring your whole self to your work, whether it's your gender, your identity, your faith, your marital status, your family status, whatever it is about you, if you feel that you can bring your whole self to your work, to your role as a parent, to your role as a friend, everything gets better. And so I became more engaging with staff. My professional relationships just blossomed, where opportunities are there that were never there for me before, or that I was never able to see them because focused too hard on hiding who I was. And with the parents, I was more engaging than ever. And I'll never forget the first time walking through the NICU after my transition. It was around Mother's Day. And I was talking with a family, with a mom who was holding her tiny little sick baby in the very same chair in the same room that my son was in. And I was just chatting with her, having really engaging, and she gave me her mom, her little baby to hold, and said, "Happy Mother's Day." And I'll never forget that. I thought, I'm going to be okay. And so my career has thrived since then. Changes my relationship with society. When you don't fit into what society expects of you, it can be very dangerous and very scary. This is not so unrealistic for people like me. I think about this every day. Is today the day that a guy is going to figure out that I'm a girl who thinks I'm all hot and then finds out that I'm a transgender person? Yep, that's very scary to me. To walk into a girl's washroom, you know, I'm okay because I pass, but what about even cisgender people that don't fit into what society expects a girl or a boy should look like? It could be very dangerous in a washroom. And we have all those conversations, even with young people trying to use these washrooms, and it's very scary. The person that's most likely, because there's always that conversation, well, what about the other people in the bathroom? We have to protect those people from pedophiles, because they're going to pretend that they're transgender people and wearing a dress and attacking girls, which is absolutely ridiculous, because the person that's most likely at risk, statistically speaking, in a washroom is me. I'm more likely to be raped in a washroom, more likely to be physically assaulted in a washroom, more likely to be murdered in a washroom than any other part of society. So who truly are we protecting when we say trans people can't use their appropriate washroom? And this is why 41% of trans people attempt suicide. It's close to 50%, depending on where you look and which age group we're talking about. It's why, like I mentioned, 50% of trans people have been raped or assaulted by a romantic partner. And these are things that we're probably not going to just talk about when we talk to you, that you're going to have to dig really deep to get to some of those issues. This is why 1 in 12 trans people have a chance of being murdered in some states in the U.S. 1 in 12. Do you realize that number changes to 1 in 8 if you're a transgender woman of color? The average age of a transgender woman of color in the United States, 34. Think about that. Think about our population. Who else has such life expectancy in this Western civilization? It's very real, it's very scary. And I've really experienced that certainly in the last few weeks. You know, that hate can be so strong. We experienced that in Edmonton with one of our members of our Edmonton Police Service who was killed investigating hate crimes. We saw a hate that was so strong yesterday, or the day before yesterday, in Charleston, South Carolina. Hate is real, and hate is very dangerous, and hate makes it very scary for people like me. In fact, I'm very public about my journey, and very public. I'm on the radio quite a bit, on TV quite a bit, and some of the comments that I've seen recently, you know, you see somebody like Caitlyn Jenner coming out, who looks amazing, and is on the cover of the of Vanity Fair, and really bringing these issues, or at least giving the rest of us a stage for a while to talk about these important issues. But with that comes a light being shone on the cockroaches of society who spew hate. And some of the things that have been directed at me, even last week, there was a comment on a interview that I did with Global and said that the only answer for people like me is a gun. Imagine living in a world where you're thinking every day, is today the day? And I don't let that fear debilitate me. I don't let that fear stop me from doing things, but I'm certainly much more aware of where I am, my surroundings. I'm much more afraid, or much more aware of who I'm with and what times. It's just something that's always in the consciousness of my being. That never used to be me before, because as a transgender person, I know what it's like to have privilege. I was a 40-year-old married Caucasian male in this province, professionally employed, with an education, straight. I know what privilege is. Let's be real about this. And I also know what it's like to lose it, because people of privilege don't have those comments made at them and about them. People of privilege don't have to be worried about going to the washroom every day. People of privilege don't have to worry that their parents are going to tell them you no longer have parents today. So we have to really be thoughtful of that, because it's a very scary place for people like me.
You're listening to People First Radio on CHLY 101.7 FM, community and campus radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. Find us on Twitter at People First Rad. We're devoting our full broadcast hour this week to sharing the audio from a presentation by Marnie Panis, delivered at the 2015 Canadian Collaborative Mental Health Care Conference in Calgary, Alberta.
Marnie Panis is a transgender woman from Edmonton, Alberta, and is one of the foremost Canadian advocates for the rights of transgender people. Her presentation was designed to help mental health care practitioners deliver appropriate and supportive services to transgender clients and family members. Marnie concluded her presentation with specific recommendations, a kind of what can you do list for service providers.
So what can you do? You can be an advocate. Be aware of the body language and facial expressions and your tone of voice. When somebody says something to you, are you going to be like, whoa, how are you going to react to that? So just to be aware of what that looks like. Express a willingness to learn about individual needs. If I throw out a term at you, say cisgender, who knows what cisgender means? Okay? Some don't. Cisgender refers to when the biological sex matches your gender. So if you're born with a penis and you're a male and you identify as male, you're a cisgender male, or transgender is the distinction between the two, if you need to make that distinction. That's not always necessary, most times not necessary. But why I'm asking that is that if I throw a term out you as a client, you know, a great way of saying, I have not heard that term before. Can you tell me what that means to you? Ask the question. It's very much okay to ask that question. And in fact, I encourage it, because that builds trust, that builds that relationship, and that's very important. You are definitely professionals in your field, but I've got the PhD in Marnie. I've got the PhD in me. So ask me about me, because I'll tell you. And if we have a really great relationship, you're going to learn a lot, and I'm going to be better off for it. Listen to what patients and families are saying. So listen to what we're actually saying about our journey. Ask questions instead of assumptions. What is your relationship? Who is your emergency contact? Instead of assuming that I have a husband or a wife. Or when you're talking to children, so what's your mom and dad's name? Let's try and say something like, who are your parents? Or do you have, you know, what? Who are the special people in your life? Be really inclusive, because you'll learn some different things about that child when you start asking the open questions instead of making the assumptions about the heterosexual norms. And acknowledging and apologizing for mistakes. We're all going to do it. You might refer to me with a male pronoun by accident. You can make a really big deal out of it, or you can say, I'm so sorry. I'm going to try better next time. I'm really sorry. And then move on. That's all you got to do. Acknowledge it and move on. You don't need a big production about it, but acknowledge it and move on. And then try not to do that again. Confidentiality is a real important piece, especially in mental health. We're always bound by our own codes of practice, our professional practice about confidentiality. And being transgender, if I'm coming out to you and sharing that in our professional environment, that is also a medical piece of information that is between you and me. And you don't just go saying to your friend, oh wow, that client I had, that Marnie's a transgender woman. You wouldn't say that any more than you would say that that person is suffering from mental illness, that person has been diagnosed with cancer. It's the same type of information that is still covered under the Health Information Act. So please recall that whatever information you need or that person needs, if you're passing along that file, then clearly that has to happen, but not in all cases. It's really up to me to tell people that I'm a transgender person. I live out there and I'm out and it's all over the place, and that's really not much of a big secret, but still up to me to share that story. You would never introduce me to, oh, hi, this is Marnie, my transgender friend, and this is Dennis, my cisgender male friend. You would never say that about Dennis. You wouldn't say that about me, or you shouldn't, right? And it's important to establish that trust with your client. Specify what information is going to be kept secret and confidential and between you in that environment, and that really helps establish that trust. So we talked about, you know, let's not use gender identity. We had I can't remember her, MLA in Alberta just spoke up in the legislature for the first time this week, who identifies as female but lesbian, stood up and said, because they always say Ms. or Mrs. or Madam or whatever, and she says, I prefer you not use any gendered pronouns when addressing me. That's quite a statement to make in the legislature, and a very good one. And so let's not just assume Ms., Mr., let's take those off our forms, let's take those off anything, and then let's just call people by how they prefer to be called and ask them. And it could be simple as saying, how can I help you today? Use gender neutral and preferred pronouns, of course, wherever possible. Like when I'm coming in, especially during my transition, it's such an awkward time because I might be dressing like a boy. It might be hair is kind of half growing out and it's kind of awkward. But if I tell you, my name is Marnie and I prefer female pronouns, even though nothing has been changed yet legally, that's what you use. That's the respectful part. That's going to happen. What name would you like me to... What would you like to be called? You can ask the question. If you're not sure, if there's some ambiguity going on and you're not really sure, you can just try to find an open-ended question. How do you prefer I call you? What pronouns prefer I use? Have you heard of a pronoun as they? Have you heard that yet? So there are many people who identify as not a gender at all and prefer to be called with the they pronoun instead of he or she. That really, it even messes me up because, of course, in our English language, they is a plural term as a pronoun. So it makes it a bit of a challenge. But that is something that you may hear out there. And what is important, though, is that you document and communicate that to others. There's nothing worse than me being in a doctor's office or in a clinic getting my blood drawn. And first of all, sitting in the waiting room and somebody call me by my male name when it's clearly all women in the waiting room, because then you've just outed me again. And I have to figure that out. And then I go and give my blood or do whatever I have to do and tell them that I'm a female, I prefer female pronouns. And the next person comes along and starts all over again. So if you're passing that information along, pass that information, at least that there. This is Marnie. Marnie prefers being called by female pronouns. That's all you got to say. So pass that along to the other people that are going to be caring for the people. Even at the front desk, if you have clerks and receptionists, all of that is important. And again, we talked about what is the mother-father's name instead, using that. Is there more than one parent? What are the parents' names? Who are the special people in your life? There's always one that I like working with children that I was working with at the Stollery. Instead of just asking them who your mom and dad were, draw a picture of your family. And sometimes the dog is the most important person that shows up on that picture. But in that little illustration, you learn something about that child. Right, and you're starting to connect and let them see where they're at in their definition of things. I remember my wife was driving down the street and there was a girl running by. She had a ponytail and she had all these kinds of things. And Alex asks, is that daddy? This was years ago. Is that daddy? And Lorena's like, oh, what do I do with this? Where do I go? And blah, blah, blah. And so she's got this whole complex thing in her mind of what he was getting at. And the fact is she had a purple shirt and I have a purple shirt. That was his connection. But as parents, we want to go like all over the place with this. So when you ask, why do you think that was daddy? Because she had a purple shirt. It's quite a bit different than she's got breasts and a ponytail and, right? Today, I feel like a person, myself. When I'm talking with my therapist, we haven't talked about my journey as a transgender person in years, probably 2 years now. I transitioned and everything's great. My conversation with my therapist now is about how do I get through the hurt of rejection of parents and family. How do I figure that out? That's probably been the bulk of it lately. But most of that is around my relationships with people and trying to just be confident within myself to avoid looking at all those negative comments online and try to be okay with that. That's where my conversations have led with my therapist. Nothing to do about me being transgender. Again, I'm probably as mentally healthy as any person in this room, considering all of the therapy I've been through, but really I am really happy. And when I think back to the last year of my life, I can tell you with full conviction and complete honesty that it is by far the happiest year of my life. Happy in a way that I never thought it could ever be. I am what I used to think was a barrier in my life. Having people know my secret has been endless, endless opportunities that I never knew existed. And now, where I thought I kind of had a finite area where I was going to go professionally and personally, unlimited now. Because I don't have to work so hard at hiding who I was. I don't have to work so hard, and it's exhausting and unsustainable to live that lie, that now I can just be me, and wow, my life is actually a lot simpler. In spite of all of the negative stuff that I might have shared, my life is simpler, happier, healthier, and it's just really, really good.
Marnie Panis is an engagement and patient experience consultant for Alberta Health Services and one of Canada's foremost advocates for the rights of transgender people. Her presentation, titled I'm Not Sick, I'm Transgender, was recorded at the 16th Canadian Collaborative Mental Health Care Conference in Calgary, Alberta on June 20th, 2015.
You can find Marnie Panis online at Facebook and on Twitter at Marnie Panis, P-A-N-A-S. You can find out more about the Canadian Collaborative Mental Health Care Conference online at sharedcare.ca. That's shared-care.ca.
People First Radio is an initiative of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and broadcast on CHLY 101.7, Radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the partnering organizations. Listen to People First Radio on demand. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpages.